The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I started coming here on Mondays 16 years ago. It's been a while. And it's very significant for me to be here in the role of a teacher. So as I was thinking about being here as a teacher, a memory came up that I wanted to share with you. Quite a few years ago, when I was in my 20s, I took part in some music master classes in Siena. It's a gorgeous place. And every evening, there was a phenomenal concert. And there's one concert that stays in my memory. This was of a very young French violinist. I remember very well how he stepped onto the stage in a very quiet, unassuming way that immediately caught my attention. Got himself on stage, picked up his violin, put it on his chin. The moment he closed his eyes and he started to play, I had the very clear sense that he had erased himself. This was way before I knew anything about anatta or the teachings of no self. But it really, I found it very inspiring, this ability of saying, I'm not important now. What's important is to convey the greatness of the music of Bach. And he did that so well that after so many years, it still stays with me. So it is in this spirit that I want to share with you the teachings. So it's not about me, in other words. What I want to talk about today is truthfulness. And I want to start with a poem by an Argentinian poet by the name of Francisco Urondo. Urondo wrote this poem in 1973 while he was in jail. He was committed to express the truth of what was happening in his country during the military junta. And he saw his poetry as a way to communicate truth. It ended up costing his life, but this is to the extent that one can commit to truthfulness. The title of the poem is Truth is the Only Reality. On the other side of the gate, there is reality. On this side of the gate, there too is reality. Freedom is real, although it's not quite known if it belongs to the world of the living, to the world of the dead, to the world of fantasies, or to the world of wakefulness. Even though it may seem at times a lie, the one and only lie is not even treason. It is simply a gate that does not belong to reality. This is an excerpt of the poem, by the way. It's not the whole thing. So as I have been investigating truthfulness, it's become very clear to me how important and essential this topic is to me. Qualities such as genuineness, sincerity, honesty, I value very highly. I see truthfulness as the foundation on which to build an ethical life. And living a life committed to truthfulness is a way to assure ourselves peace and joy. So as we investigate this topic of truthfulness, I invite you to keep the image of the poem of Urondo. So for most of us, when we think about truthfulness, I think the first thing that comes to mind is speaking the truth. But there are other aspects that I find very interesting and worth investigating. And that is, for example, the ability to perceive reality accurately, which of course is central to this practice. And it requires a still and clear mind to be able to perceive reality accurately. And then, of course, the ability to be being truthful to ourselves. It is easily said, but as I think most of you know, it is quite difficult to be true to oneself. I spent years trying to please my parents of what they wanted from me, and it's taken me a long time to find out what it was really that was true for me. So I think that there are two aspects of can help us tremendously to develop this truthfulness with ourselves. It's very simple. It's just making time and giving ourselves a kind and sustained attention. It can take various ways of expression, this kind and sustained attention. But I find that meditation and these teachings are an ideal way to give ourselves this attention in order to cultivate truthfulness, in order to know really what is it, what we want, what is it that we really are all about. I've also found that living our truth can be quite a lonely path. Often we come to crossroads in the road where it's very difficult and we have to let go of loved ones because we're not anymore in this on the same path. We've walked for a while together and then it's time to take different paths. This search is an ongoing process. We are never done. For me, it's taken many, many years to be able to get to the point where I have my livelihood, housing, and spiritual and my spiritual practice aligned with who I am. And of course, I'm not done. So I see this search for truthfulness as we're aiming at every moment to do and say whatever it is that we're saying to be in accord with our inner truth. I've heard Gil say a couple of times something that stayed with me, and that is that this beautiful peace that we get to in the Buddhist path doesn't have anything to do with how wealthy we are, how much we know, who do we know, what do we have, but it has all to do with how true we are with ourselves. Truthfulness, as some of you know, is one of the 10 paramis. You know, this is just a list of 10 qualities that are called the paramis. And parami in Pali means perfection. So it means like there are these qualities. But how do you perfect them? So how do you perfect truthfulness? So the idea is, if you're practicing truthfulness with the intention of being compassionate and of freeing yourself more and more from suffering, then you're practicing it as a parami. So now I want to take some time to unpack truthfulness. I see truthfulness as having three parts or three aspects. The first one is what is. The second one is perception, how we perceive what is. And the third one we could say is the way we externalize this perception. Now, we may say that truthfulness is the correspondence of these three parts. These correspondence might be from something external, you know, like an experience, like we see something, to something internal, or from something internal, like a thought or an emotion, to something external that we may externalize as with body language or, of course, with words. So let us look at the first aspect, which is what is. Some of us here present were part of the one-month retreat at Spirit Rock. And let's see if it stays. And during this month, I took it as a practice to ask myself continually, what is true right now? I found it very interesting and revealing, because it made me see how often we want to just sweep away those mind states that we don't like, that we are uncomfortable with. So I got a lot of practice with being comfortable with uncomfortable mind states by posing this question over and over again. So, of course, mindfulness is all about truthfulness, right? If we think about it, it's all about knowing what's happening in the moment. And not only knowing what's happening in the moment, but not grasping what is pleasant or pushing away what's unpleasant. So I want to give you an example that in a way can express this complex correspondence of truthfulness. I grew up in Mexico in the ballet world. And as a child, I had the very unusual opportunity to go to a performance of the Bolshoi Ballet Company that was visiting from the then Soviet Union. And what was unusual about this experience is that for whatever unknown reason, my mother was invited to watch the performance from the catwalk. And so I got to go along. So there I sat on a stool, and I had this view over the stage. And it was quite fascinating to see the mad rushing of the stage crew and the lights changing and the scenery coming down and the dancers pacing up and down nervously. And then suddenly, the quiet. The lights were set. The scenery was set. There was silence for a moment, and then the orchestra started to play. I could see the dancers waiting in between, just in backstage, getting ready to come out, waiting for their musical cue. They were even crossing themselves, which I thought was kind of interesting for Russian dancers. So as the curtain was completely gone, it was very interesting that one could see what was happening on stage, what was happening behind stage, behind the scenery, and one could actually even see part of the audience. So as I think about that memory, I've asked myself, you know, how often do we have the experience in life to see things as they are? And to see not only what's up front, the facade, but also what's behind it. So we can say that we all start by viewing life as if on stage, unaware of the make-believe. Few of us ever feel compelled to look behind the curtain and investigate How is it that this make-believe world comes to be? I think this practice is wonderful for inviting us to watch life from the catwalk and to be conscious of not only the occurrences of what's happening in life's stage, but also of our inner machinations as the equivalent of the activities backstage. So now let's look at perception. I don't know if you remember some of the mirrors that we used to find in fairs where you stepped in front of the mirror and you suddenly saw yourself long and skinny like a Giacometti statue, and then this short and stout like a little troll. And I bring this up because the mind is just like that. Our minds, not unlike those mirrors, distort. About a week ago, one of the people in my Dharma Spanish group was telling me that he remembered an exercise that we did 2 years ago. And in that exercise, I played some sounds and asked them to identify the sounds. So one person, when I played this particular sound, was very distraught by the sound and described it as children with tremendous anxiety crying. And he was very upset by the sound. When it came time to share for each one what each individual had heard, one woman identified the sound accurately. You know, it was the calls of whales. And she said it was the most beautiful and calming sound. So this man was stunned, and I think it was really the first time that he had the insight of the tremendously subjective or subjectivity of our perception. She's falling down. Okay. Thank you for telling me. Okay, here we go. So we can say that our background and our education, our personality, our gender, all these aspects distort our mind. It becomes the lens through which we see life. And not to mention if we're dealing with like the five hindrances of desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, doubt, all of these, of course, will completely distort our ability to see clearly. So this practice gradually teaches us how our perception is the lens of the self, and that this lens of the self distorts, and so we learn that what we experience is our truth, but not the truth. So if we bring back the image of Urondo's poem, and I'll read the first lines again. On the other side of the gate, there is reality. On this side of the gate, there too is reality. So mind states, such as the hindrances, or also the three unwholesome roots, greed, hatred, and delusion, can be seen as the gate that gets in the way of perceiving reality. So as we become more and more aware of how easy it is to distort, we might become discouraged. But actually, the moment that we are aware of how subjective it is, our our perception, we've already made a big step forward. And now to the third part, the expression when it comes time to express ourselves, talk our truth. I want to read you a quote by Bhikkhu Bodhi. He says, "To realize truth, our whole being has to be brought into accord with actuality. With things as they are, which requires that in communications with others, we respect things as they are by speaking the truth. Truthfulness, truthful speech establishes a correspondence between our inner being and the real nature of phenomena, allowing wisdom to rise up. Thus, much more than an ethical principle, devotion to truthful speech is a matter of taking our stand on reality rather than illusion, on the truth grasped by wisdom rather than the fantasies woven by desire." So some of you know that not lying is one of the five precepts. So the others being not killing, not stealing, not engaging in harmful sexual behavior, and not intoxicating the mind. Now what I find very wonderful about these five precepts is that they're not to be taken as commandments, but as a way to protect ourselves and others. And one of the ways that I feel that we can protect ourselves and others is by committing to being truthful. So it's a wonderful gift that we can give others by being trustworthy. Here's another quote from the Majjhima Nikaya about truthfulness of what one knows. "What is verbal conduct in accordance with the Dhamma? Here's someone abandoning false speech, abstains from false speech. When summoned to a court or to a meeting or to one's relative's presence or to one's guild or to the royal family's presence and questions as a witness thus, 'So good person, tell what you know.' Not knowing, one would say, 'I don't know.' Or knowing, one says, 'I know.' Not seeing, one says, 'I do not see.' Or seeing, one says, 'I see.' One does not, in full awareness, speak falsehood for one's own needs or for another's end or for some trifling worldly end." Some years ago, I was at a conference at Stanford, and one of the young faculty members, the only woman in the department, was going to present a paper that was very important for her career. And one of the leading figures in the field was going to be present, so it was a big deal for her. She gave her presentation, and at the end, this leading figure, who was dreaded, of course, came up with a very tricky question. This woman very calmly responded, "My research has not taken me to that place yet, so I cannot answer, so I don't know." And it really stayed with me because, as many of you know, this is quite unusual in academia to have this candid, "I don't know" response. We are trained to be very agile at answering ourselves away, even if we don't know. You get very agile at producing words and somehow answering, but never, never, never saying, "I don't know." So it takes courage to say, "I don't know." But it's refreshing when we encounter somebody who can actually just be that truthful. So now I want to explore the more interesting but also very difficult aspect of truthfulness with ourselves. And for that, I found a story that I think works very well to explore this topic. It's a story by John Steinbeck, and it's called Molly Morgan. Some of you might know. I'll just give you the very general bits of the story so we can make the point. The story begins when Molly, as a young girl, is growing up in a really very harsh environment and poverty-stricken. And this young girl, in order to survive this harsh environment, she creates a fantasy around her father. Her father, who was mainly absent, would appear sporadically, loaded with gifts for the children and full of wonderful stories of adventures of wherever he had been. Molly holds these memories of her father as a myth as she grows up. And she pushes away the harsh reality, which really was that her father was an absent husband and father. He was a drunkard and also completely irresponsible, leaving the mother to fend off by herself to somehow find a way to feed the children. One of these many absences prolongs and prolongs to years. But Molly continues to nourish this fantasy that her father is going to come back one day and he's going to bring gifts and is going to tell her stories and she's going to be happy. The story then jumps forward about 10 years. Now we find Molly as a 19-year-old. She made her way successfully through adolescence, and she now is a school teacher. She's living in a very friendly and pleasant environment, and her teaching is valued. Several things happen in the story so that somebody visiting where she lives begins to talk about somebody who sounds very dangerously alike her father. And not only that, but this person speaking, he says, this day laborer who is hopelessly drunk, I keep finding him in the street. I have him right now out in the street by my car. He's totally drunk. So Molly jumps up, and as if driven by some force, she goes out of the house. As she is approaching the gate to get out of the garden, she hears the words in her mind, "Now I'm going to die." She knows that if she opens that gate and she's confronted with the truth, that part of her will have to die. She would have to let go of the myth of the heroic figure that she built herself and has fed throughout her life. So how does Molly relate to this possibility of finding out the truth with terror? Definite, the terror. She runs back to the house, and so Molly chooses to evade the truth and to retrieve back to her world of fantasies. She believes that she can run away from the truth. At the end of the story, Molly has decided to go away, to leave behind this lovely situation that she had built for herself and her job. Grasping to her fantasy world, she tells herself, once I'm away, I'll be able not to believe it. Now, as a child, her fantasy served a purpose. They allowed her to find a refuge in a very difficult situation. And children do this. It is a way for them to protect themselves when they feel very vulnerable because they depend on the adults. But now, as an adult, we know that her choosing to evade the truth, that she will live a life very, very constricted. Now, what is important for us, dharmically speaking, about this story? So first of all, I want to mention, notice that as in the poem and in the story, we have a gate and not a wall. And the nature of a gate is that it can be opened. Our practice brings us over and over again to this gate. And we too feel terror. So we train our minds and hearts so that we may have the courage to open the gate and not run away, and to be willing to have parts of us die. So to finish, I want to read to you again the poem of Francisco Urondo. Truth is the only reality. On the other side of the gate, there is reality. On this side of the gate, there too is reality. Freedom is real, although it's not quite known if it belongs to the world of the living, to the world of the dead, to the world of fantasies, or to the world of wakefulness. Even though it may seem at times a lie, the one and only lie is not even treason. It is simply a gate that does not belong to reality. So why don't we take about 1 or 2 minutes of silence just to take in and to switch over to some questions. So if anybody has a comment, a question.
Please use the microphone.
So my question is, what can you know for certain? Like, if you're the, say you're hearing the sound of the whale and everything comes through your perception, how do you know if it's truly the children or truly the whale? So, like, what can you ever know, since everything's coming through our perception, what can you ever know is true, is really true?
That's an excellent question. And I want to start by putting it back to you in this, in the way of, have you ever been in a situation where You felt, this is true, this is the truth. And if so, how would you describe it?
I think I've been in that situation when it's been absolutely false. I can remember more of those times. I mean, because those have been proven to be false. The other times, you know, I might think it's true, mm-hmm. but I'm not really ever certain if it's mm-hmm. true. You know, like the ones that were proven to be false, I knew were false because they were proven to be false. The other ones may have actually been false, but they all seemed true to me at one point. I don't know if I've ever had an experience where I absolutely, without a doubt, knew that was truth.
Yeah. So I think that it's really not so important if we get it right. You know, if actually our perception corresponds with what is. But what is really important and helps us tremendously and will really save us a lot of suffering in our lives is to keep in mind constantly how relative our perceptions are. Because how many times have we been in an argument with somebody else and we say, no, I know it's this and this and this and this. And the other person says, no, I know that it is this, this, and that. And so, you know, to just more often say, maybe, you know, the way I perceive it is this. But we know that you know, it's our reality, but not the truth necessarily. Just having that distinction really puts you on the other side. And it's okay if we don't get it right. We're not going to get it right many times. Hope it helps.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to hear your thoughts about this. When we're younger and we're in our formative years, we let, you know, the negative experiences shape the lens through which we see ourselves for the rest of our lives. And in my experience, I haven't really let the positive experiences change that lens. Instead, I let the negative experiences reinforce, you know, what has already been, you know, the lens that has already been shaped. So how would you, you know, train yourself to slowly revert back and, you know, look at things differently, look at yourself differently, instead of letting, you know, experiences from your childhood shape the way you see yourself?
Yeah. That's a very useful thing to be able to do. You know, the first thing that came to my mind, if some of you have read Rick Hansen's book, The Buddha's Brain, I recommend it very, very highly, because he speaks about how our brain, when we think a thought repeatedly, we actually create a kind of a groove in our brain. And so we're likely to fall back into that groove more easily. But so if it's a negative thought, well, then of course you're going to keep falling back into that. If we manage to begin to see our really true nature, which everybody has a beautiful true nature, then we begin to create a new groove. Now, how do we create this new way of looking ourselves? This practice, I think, has done a lot for me. It's a matter of bringing this kind attention to yourself. Developing the awareness of that very negative voice inside of us that judges us and criticizes us mercilessly. I was stunned when I started to meditate seriously and I became aware of that voice. And it was ruthless. It's like, where is it coming from? So just discovering that voice is tremendously useful. And then little by little, you exchange that voice for a kind voice, a kind attention. And more quickly, you begin to notice when you start to fall back to judging yourself. And you say, no, I have an option. I don't need to go there. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, good luck. So it's 9:00, so thank you very much.